the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Well, thanks, Jack. Let's read, shall we, from the New Testament. There's so many Bibles up here. We're going to read from Matthew chapter 7. In the New Testament. This church is spending a year looking at the Gospel of Matthew, and we're just reaching today the end of the first section of that. So we're in Matthew chapter 7, that's page 919 on the in the Green Bible, which is in front of you there. And if you want to follow it through, we'll read the whole chapter very briefly and then comment on it. So here we go, Matthew chapter 7, verse 1. "Do not judge," says Jesus, "or you too will be judged. For in the same way as you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in someone else's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say, 'Let me take this speck out of your eye,' when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite! First take the plank out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from the other person's eye. Do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. Those who seek find. And to those who knock, the door will be opened. Which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ferocious wolves. By their fruit you'll recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only those who do the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name drive out demons? And in your name perform many miracles?' Then I will tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.' Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the storms rose, and the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law." That's all we're going to read, and it's a massive, massive chunk. It really is. In fact, one of the best things you could probably do with this whole journey through Matthew this year is read Matthew chapter 7 every day of the year. There'll be something different in it every day for you. I can say that with some confidence, because when I was 15, I remember going to a camp where the speaker challenged the young people who were there to go home and read a book of the New Testament every day for a month. I think he meant something like Philippians 4 chapters or Colossians 4 chapters. But me, being logical and stupid, thought, right, start at the beginning, Matthew, 28 chapters. And it just about killed me getting through 28 chapters every day for a month. But it was one of the best things I've ever done in my life. And one of the things that stunned me was just how much there was how rich it was every day, even at 15 years old, reading that book again and again and again. There were new things opening up and emerging through it every single time I read it. And it was a tremendous introduction to the richness of God's Word. Well, now, one of the richest bits of this whole book is chapter 7. And this is an extended excuse for not saying very much about it this morning, because we're covering so much of it. But do read it, take it to heart, think about all the things I'm not going to mention today. I've had to be pretty selective. But it's important that we do finish off this first series of talks that we've got on Matthew's Gospel right here. Because Matthew's based around five different great discourses of Jesus. And this is the absolute fundamental one, the one that people have heard of if they've never heard of anything else that Jesus said, the Sermon on the Mount. This is a conclusion to the whole thing. And it's important that we realize what the Sermon on the Mount is for and who it's for as well. I first realized that, I think, a few years after that, when I was in my 20s, when I saw this painting. Can we have the PowerPoint up? Thank you, that's great. It's a painting from the 17th century by Claude Lorrain, and it's called The Sermon on the Mount. It's a bit dark in that version there. But I'll describe it to you, and you'll see a better version of it further on. It's been smoke damaged through the years, so the colours have gone very dark. And basically, you have Jesus preaching on the mount. That's the mount in the middle of it there. And down at the bottom, you've got all the sightseers, the people who've come to listen to him. Now, you might think that this early in Jesus' career, that was what he was doing, attracting people, trying to get them to listen. This sermon is preached to people who weren't really disciples yet, who were just making up their mind whether this guy had anything to offer or not. Not true. And Jesus, in that painting, is up on the hill, and his disciples are gathered around him. Wait a minute, it's disappeared. What's going on here? There we are. Yes, that's the bit that matters. That's where Jesus is. If you blow it up, you can't see anything. Never mind. It looks fine on my screen down here. But fear not, because 4 years ago, David Hockney, the British artist, had a look at this Lorrain painting and thought, I can do something with this. And he couldn't clean up the original because nobody would let him, so he did his own version. And that's the Hockney version, which is a little bit clearer, as you can see. There are the disciples with Jesus at the top of the hill, and there's the crowd down the bottom. And that must have been the way it was. Because if you look at the start of the sermon, back in chapter 5, what it says is this: when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside. That's not the way to publicize yourself, is it? When Jesus saw the crowds, he made a speech. When Jesus saw the crowds, he started signing autographs. When Jesus saw the crowds, he didn't. He went up a hill. And you can imagine them all coming from all the parts of Galilee to see him, and there he is, going up a hill. Charming, wonderful. But he only wanted to speak to the people who really mattered. The people who were really following him. The people who were already tangling with his message. And so you've got Jesus and the people that the message is for at the top of the hill, and everybody else down the bottom. So never think that this is a sermon for those who are not following Jesus. It's about those of us who are following him. These are the principles of following him. This filtering process goes through before the sermon starts. Jesus goes up the hill, says chapter 5, and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. So this is for people who are trying to follow Jesus. And Charles Price, who's written an interesting commentary on the book of Matthew, says this: the crowd was present and went away amazed at the end and having heard what Jesus had to say, but he was not addressing them. He spoke to his disciples. This, therefore, is not primarily an evangelistic sermon addressed to unbelievers with a view to bringing them to discipleship. It's for Christians. Now, if you're not a Christian, you're here this morning, this is not license to switch off and go to sleep for the next 30 minutes, because I think you'll find it quite interesting finding out what Jesus really expects of his disciples. So do eavesdrop, by all means. But it's really for those who are trying to follow Jesus. And I suppose you could say, Charles Price says, that the Sermon on the Mount falls into two bits. First of all, it talks about what we're supposed to be. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world, things like that. And then it talks about what we're supposed to do. So the first bit of it is about the character of the Christian. This is what God wants us to be like. And the second thing is, this is about how you live it out, the conduct of the Christian. So in that first bit, you've got chapter 5, 1 to 16, the stuff we were talking about in New Key, or back here if you weren't at New Key, the beautiful attitudes that Christians are supposed to have. Being the salt of the earth, being the light of the world. What does that mean? And then he swings into the conduct section, and the rest of chapter 5 talks about our relationship to the law of God and the Old Testament. How does a Christian live out those commands from centuries ago? Chapter 6 is about our reputation, where our treasure is, where we really stake our values in life. And chapter 7, else's price. That's about our priorities. And there are five great priorities that are mentioned in this chapter, so that's where we're going to be talking about this morning. What are the five? First of all, there's the priority of the judgments that you make. That's the start of the chapter. Do not judge, or you too will be judged. How do we assess other people? How do we assess ourselves? That's one of the first vital things we've got to get right. Then there are the prayers you pray. How much can you believe God for? What do you think God is going to do for you? Ask, seek, knock. That's the second priority. How big is your faith? Third, there's the road you travel. Because Jesus says there are two ways. There's a broad road that leads to destruction. There's a narrow way that leads to life. And he says, few there be that find it. So which road are you on? And remember, he's speaking to Christians. He's not speaking to non-Christians. We'll come back and talk about that. Fourth, there are the voices you hear. And Jesus starts talking about the voices you can trust. The people who are sending you on the right road, on the narrow path. And those who are just saying what you want to hear. False prophets. People wrapped up who look as if they're telling the truth, but actually are telling you lies. Finally, there are the foundations you build. Are you building on the rock? Are you building on the sand? And Jack's already challenged us about that one this morning. So let's have a quick look at those five sections. First of all, the judgments you make. Jesus tells a story about the speck of dust in somebody's eye that you're trying to get out and the great plank that's sticking out of your one. Why does he start off here? Why is this the number one priority? Well, I think for two reasons. Number one, because we judge ourselves by other people. It's a natural human thing to do. And one of the toughest things to do in the Christian life, I think, is to learn to judge yourself by the standards of Jesus and not just by people around you. We all tend to look at other folks and think, well, he's doing that, so I will. She's on that kind of level, so if I'm there, I must be all right. And we think we're okay as long as we're like the rest of the crowd. Jesus says it's not like that. And we can put other people down. And it's a great emotional relief sometimes to do that. We see in them the same faults we see in ourselves. We think, ha, I know what she's about. I know what he's on. Oh, at least I'm not like that. And we make ourselves feel better because we're judging other people. Now, when Jesus says, judge not that you be not judged, he didn't mean pass judgment on nobody, because you've got to do that. If you're a Christian employer and you've got three people that come to be interviewed for a job, you've got to judge between them, haven't you? Who's going to be the right person for the job? You can't say, well, on the basis of Matthew chapter 7, I'm going to flip a coin. You might end up with some pretty awful employees. You've got to judge. If you meet somebody on the street who says, can you help me? I've got no money. I've got to go 500 miles to get back home. I just need £30. When you listen to a sob story like that, is it true? Is it genuine? Is it on the level? Will you really help this person by giving them money? Will it go on alcohol? You've got to make judgments. Life is about making judgments. But what Jesus is saying here is, do not condemn so that you will not be condemned. Don't write people off. He's just a. She will never be any good. He'll never change. Don't do that. The way you judge other people has something to do with your own self-assessment. The other reason I think that this comes at the start is because the Christian life is supposed to be lived together. We're part of the same family. We belong with one another. And so anything that I say that impacts your life, and there'll be plenty I say that does impact your life because we're part of a family. Anything I say that impacts your life is serious and important and needs to be a top priority. So Jesus says, careful with the judgments you make. They reflect back on you and your self-image and the way you look at yourself. And I guess the question that this whole section is asking us is, how do you assess yourself? How do you look at yourself? Are you trying to build your confidence and your sense of assurance by doing down other people? By comparing yourself favorably to struggling brothers and erring sisters? To people who are not quite on the same level as you are? Are you feeling, well, I'm okay because I'm not what Jesus says I should be, but I'm better than them? Jesus says, judge not that you be not judged. How do you assess yourself? But he's only just started. The second area of priority is the prayers you pray. And we'll come back to this later on because I think this is the heart of the whole chapter. But basically, Jesus is saying here that God has got infinite supplies for us if we just believe that. He says, what father? If God is a father, he says, how is he going to do you down? Why should you worry about how God is going to meet your needs? If your son asks for bread, will a father give him a stone? If he asks for a fish, will he give him a snake? You won't do that. And yet often we think, well, if I ask God for this, he might do something nasty to me. He might make me cut off all my hair and go into a monastery. He might send me out as a missionary to Borneo. He might make something nasty and dramatic happen in my life. God is a God we can trust. And so Jesus says, ask, seek, and knock. Now, he says that three times, doesn't he, in those different ways. And each time there's a slightly different emphasis. Think about the picture involved. Ask, and it will be given to you. Here he's talking about the equipment we need for living life, the things we haven't got. And he's saying, ask God, and the equipment you don't possess is going to be given to you. Everything you need, you will get. I can testify to that because I remember when we got married, I was just going into work with Youth for Christ, which in those days paid no salaries to anybody of any kind. And we had to live, quote unquote, by faith for the first 6 years of our married life. I then got a salary, but it was one I had to raise myself, so it was pretty much the same thing. And I was hopeless at asking people for money. You know, when you're Scots, you feel kind of embarrassed about that because people think you're mean and all the rest of it. But so I was hopeless at raising my own salary. And it was just a case, really, of trusting what God sent along. He never, ever let us down. I remember saying to Anthea the morning we decided to get married, of course, we'll be living in a council house for the rest of our lives. Hadn't reckoned with Maggie Thatcher, but that's another issue. And even before we were married, we found that a Christian who was a mortgage controller at Nationwide Building Society said, of course you can have a mortgage, no problem whatsoever. And so we've never lived in a council house. And the way in which God met our needs was absolutely stupendous. And although I'm not living on that basis anymore, I could see for a few years when I had to do it without any guaranteed source of income that God was faithful to meet our needs. And so Jesus says, ask. God will supply it. Don't doubt him. Trust him. He can meet those needs. He really can. And if you're facing financial hardship this morning, if you're facing possible redundancy, if you're looking at a future where the figures just don't add up, don't get stressed about it. Trust God. I'm not saying don't do your homework, don't save money, don't do all the sensible things, but trust God. He's going to bring you through it. Ask, you'll receive. And then there's seek. And seeking is about looking for something you haven't got. I think it's about answers. And Jesus is saying here, the answers you don't have will be found. Not just will the equipment be given, but the answers will arrive. And we often get in puzzled situations in life where we really don't know where we're going, don't we? And Jesus is saying, you'll get the answers. Now, like the equipment, I've got to say very carefully, it may not arrive just when you want it. And it may not be the answer you're waiting for, because God is bigger than you and knows better than you when you need what you need. And all too often in life, I know I've prayed for something thinking, this is what I really need. God, why can't you see it? It's so obvious, staring you in the face. Please just give me it. And he's given me something completely different. And I thought, ha, I asked for a fish and here's a stone. Only to find that God doesn't give stones. It was a fish all along. I just didn't recognize it to start with. And sometimes what God gives you isn't what you expect, and isn't in the timing that you would want, but it's the right thing. And sometimes you don't get the answers when you've got unanswered questions, and you have to live with dilemmas and questions in your mind, but Jesus says, everybody who seeks, finds. The answers come when you need them. And there's a third bit too, knock. And that's not about equipment, that's not about answers, that's about access. Knock, and the door will be open to you. Often there are barriers you can't get through, places you can't go, experiences you can't get to, and it seems that everything is saying, no, 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 this will never happen to you. Jesus says, if this is God's will, if this is the right thing for you, knock. The door's going to open. It's going to swing open wide, and you're going to find yourself doing things you never dreamt of. I don't think I've ever admitted this before, but when I first came to Exeter, which is 1987, I was really, really envious of one of the first people I met who was the chaplain of Exeter School. He had such a great job. And I thought, I would love to be in that position. And you know what? I thought, I'll never be that way because I'm not an ordained Anglican, and they only have ordained Anglicans in that job. It's a job that is being done very successfully by somebody very different from me. I have a job to do at Belmont Chapel. Well, you know what? For 12 years now, I have been the chaplain of Exeter School. And it's been absolutely brilliant. The door opened. And it's amazing how God will open doors that you never expect. You look at it and say, this is impossible. But God opens doors. The Apostle Paul in the New Testament writes, a great door for effective ministry has opened unto me, and so I'm going to stay here. There are many adversaries, but God has opened the door. And that's the way he does things. And sometimes when you think, I will never get there, that will never happen to me, it cannot be done, God is a God of infinite possibilities. Ask, seek, knock. And so the question, I suppose, here is, well, how do you assess yourself, that was the first one, but what do you depend on? Are you depending on your own wits, your own native intelligence, the resources you have already to see you through? Or are you trusting in the infinite supply of a God who's got more equipment than you can dream of, more answers than you need, and more access to different places than you can possibly go in one lifetime? That's the question, isn't it? Then there's the third section, and we're bombing through it at great speed, but we've got to do that. There's the road you travel, and there's this famous section about the narrow gate and the broad way. Wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction. And you might think, well, this is a great evangelistic sermon, and it's been used in that way many times, hasn't it? There's the narrow way, following Christ all the way to heaven, and there's the broad road that leads to destruction. And that's basically what this cartoon, which I've filched from the internet, is saying. You can be going along the broad way to destruction, and then you realize destruction is coming, and you think, I'll take the exit, and you go off and follow Jesus instead. But that actually, it seems to me, is not what is being said here. It's not talking about non-Christians. It may be true that if you're not a Christian, you're on a broad, easy way that's leading right to destruction, and you need to look around and realize what Jesus has done and go his way instead. But this is a passage that's addressed to Christians, people who are disciples, people who are followers. Anyway, so they're not heading for destruction, are they? Well, yes. The New Testament talks about the possibility that you can live a Christian life that leads to the destruction of everything you're living for. You yourself will be saved in the end, but as one escaping from the flames in a burning house. That's how the New Testament puts it. All of your works may be burned up. Everything you've been living for, the priorities you've set yourself, the agenda you've lived by, that all just disappears. This is what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 3. No one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. If anyone builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, their work will be shown for what it is. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each person's work. If what has been built survives, the builder will receive a reward. If it's burned up, the builder will suffer loss, but yet will be saved as one escaping through the flames. That's the challenge, I think, that Jesus is giving his disciples here. You can live your life for nothing very much, for futility. You can amuse yourself to death. And then what have you got left at the end of it? Or you can go the narrow way. Follow Jesus and find that's the way that real life is. There's an interesting Pinterest page on the internet where a Christian who's got hold of this idea very, very strongly has just put together as many pictures of narrow paths as he possibly can, just to make the point that sometimes the narrow path is the only one to get you through. And there's a lot of sheep in it as well, because pretty clearly we're sheep and we need that kind of path. But it's not all about sheep. Sometimes humans have to take narrow paths as well. And all of this is just saying one thing, and there's a picture on that Pinterest page about that as well, which is simply this: stay on path. Don't wander off. Because when you start wandering off, you get into danger, don't you? And that is the difficulty. We need to realize that we can live for all sorts of stuff here that are temporary and not worthwhile, and living for what's permanent and valuable and going to get there in the end. That's what's important. I've been reading this week a book called The Secret Life of Bletchley Park. You know about Bletchley Park? That's where they cracked the Enigma Code in the Second World War. And this strange bunch of civilians, academics, military figures, civil servants, all sorts of people were pitchforked together to live in a very strange community. Nobody really knew who was in charge. The work got done, but more by kind of common agreement than pulling rank on folks. And it was a kind of higgledy-piggledy arrangement, but nonetheless it did fantastic work in the Second World War, some of which is only just now coming to light. And Paul Calvo-Coresi, who was one of them there, said this: looking back, I remember no talk about how long the war was likely to last, but I do not think that anyone felt it was going to last long enough seriously to divert the course of our lives. This was subconsciously important. It meant there was very little jockeying for position among us. Our futures and our war work were unrelated. And the reason they all got on so well was because they were thinking, this is temporary. It's not going to last. We are not here forever. This is a blip in our lives. Our real lives are somewhere else. And you know, we're in a war. We're living up against the assaults of the evil one day by day as we go through life in this world. And if you think that this world is forever, if you think that what you've got now is for keeps, then you live in a certain way. Jesus is saying, don't think that way. See what you've got now is temporary. The real goal, the real life is somewhere else. And one of these days you'll be there. So live for those priorities. C.S. Lewis once said this, most of us find it very difficult to want heaven at all, except insofar as heaven means meeting again our friends who've died. One reason that we have difficulty with the idea of heaven is that we've not been trained. Our whole education tends to fix our minds on this world. Another reason is that when the real want for heaven is present in us, we do not recognize it. Most people, if they had really learned to look into their own hearts, would know that they do want, and want acutely, something that cannot be had in this world. This is what Lewis called a Sehnsucht, a longing for something beyond the material, beyond even the best experiences, the topmost relationships, the most meaningful things that can happen to us in our life. We still want more. Why? Because we're creatures of eternity. Ecclesiastes says God has set eternity in our hearts. One life is not enough, and living for one life will never satisfy. This guy realized that. This is Stuart Hamblin, who was a legend in early 20th century cowboy film. Well, from the 1920s onwards anyway. He was a young guy who was the first and original singing cowboy. And he's got his own star on Hollywood Boulevard to say so. And Hamblin found success very early. He had multiple talents. He was a great singer, songwriter, composer. He was also a brilliant broadcaster. His voice was one of the most popular on the radio. He made films with Roy Rogers, John Wayne, Gene Autry, all sorts of people like that. He was one of the stars. And then in 1949, a young preacher came on his radio show in California. He was starting a campaign in town. Nobody had heard much about him. His name was Billy Graham, but nobody had ever heard of that. And Hamblin had him into the radio show and was intrigued by what he had to say. And so went along to the crusade meeting that night. And he went back absolutely hit between the eyes. Why? Well, because Hamblin was living for the moment. He was living for what he could get out of life. He was a bit of a drunk. Alcohol was playing a very large part in his life. His wife was quite worried about the relationship. And he was living the good life. His wife didn't know this, but he was quite a womanizer as well. He was living in a way that just exploited his fame to the full, because his motto was, while you've got it, use it. It won't be there for long. And that night he couldn't sleep. And so at 4 a.m., he and his wife drove to Billy Graham's hotel and woke him up and said, listen, we need to sort this out. And Billy Graham staggered him by saying, I've been praying for you for the last month. And that just did it. He just broke down in tears. Came to Christ that night. And it changed his whole life around. And he wrote a song about that experience called Until Then. And the words go like this. My heart can sing when I pause to remember. Each heartache here is but a stepping stone. And on the road that's leading ever upward, this troubled world is not my final home. The things of earth may dim and lose their splendor when we recall they're borrowed for a while. And things of earth that cause our heart to tremble, remembered there, will only bring a smile. But until then, my heart will go on singing. Until then, with joy I'll carry on. Until the day my eyes behold the city. Until the day God calls me home. And that song's meant a tremendous amount to people since, because it says, this is not permanent. This is not what life is about. Real life is somewhere else. So live by those values. Follow that path. Later on, actually, he met John Wayne on the street in Hollywood. And Wayne said, I hear you've had a spiritual experience. Come and have a drink and tell me about it. And Hamblin said, I'll come and tell you about it, but I won't have a drink. And Wayne said, really? You? You're one of the biggest lushies I know. Come on. And Hamblin said, no, I'm never going to drink again. Wayne said, so what's the secret? Hamblin said, it's no secret, John, what God can do. And Wayne was a bit uncomfortable with that. So he said, good title for a song. You ought to write it. And so Hamblin wrote that one too. It is no secret what God can do. What he's done for others, he can do for you. With arms wide open, He'll welcome you. It is no secret what God can do. What path are you travelling? Two more bits before we finish, though. The third question here, then, I suppose, is how wide do you wander? You may be a Christian. You may be living as a signed-up, card-carrying member of the kingdom of God, but do you live that way? How narrow is the path you're following? Do you stay on it? Do you wobble off? Do you make compromises? Have you got your own agenda? Those are the questions that Jesus is asking here. Fourth section in, the voices you hear. Jesus starts talking about false prophets. And he says there are two ways you can recognize them. First of all, you can recognize them by the clothes they wear. They look just like everybody else. They look like preachers of the truth. They look as if they're perfectly regular routine figures. But the way you'll tell that they're different is by the second thing, the fruit they produce. Because out of their lives will come chaos and misery, unfulfillment and disillusionment. And Jesus is highlighting this because he knows that we're going to listen to other people's voices. We're going to follow leaders. We're going to accept influences into our life. And he's saying, which voices are you listening to? Are you listening to the people who are just prophesying smooth things, who are saying the sorts of things that you want to listen to? Or are you listening to the truth, however hard it comes, however much it hurts? It's an important question for us right now, because there has never been an age in the history of the Christian church like the last 30 years when a massive number of Christian leaders have fallen by the wayside, when people who have been superstars in the evangelical galaxy have been proven to have feet of clay. I think that's probably the problem. We have superstars. We have a system where people can be under bright lights and their books can be sold all over the world. They can become instant heroes to millions of people. And all too often, the spiritual maturity isn't there. This guy at the bottom, Jeff Bullock, one of the leading worship singer-songwriters in Australia, a guy who wrote songs that we sing here, The Power of Your Love, songs like that. He was big. He was massive. And then suddenly the whole thing came to an end. There was a marriage breakup, suggestions of adultery, all sorts of stuff. He lost his ministry. And he says as a result of that, I was the hero, if you like. I was the poster boy who stood behind the microphone and played the piano. But it wasn't me. I knew who I was. I knew God knew who I was. I was always disappointed that I could never rise to the standards that I so desperately wanted to attain. And I was just waiting for someone to unveil the hoax. And he says, I kept thinking, I'm not this person. Why is this happening? I remember in my dark times wondering, is this some kind of cosmic joke? There's this person out there who's empty inside. He's just a little shell. He looks like he's such a success, and yet he feels such a failure. He's a puppet out there, a performer singing and dancing, but inside there's nothing, and eventually it's going to self-destruct, and it did. I never let the real person be there, because he wouldn't have been accepted. I couldn't accept him. And this summary of the whole fall that he's gone through is like this: the world likes stars, because it's easier to measure success by works than to measure acceptance by grace. When grace is given for absolutely no reason other than unmerited love, then we can't feel worthy in ourselves. We need works to measure ourselves by to make us feel accepted. We much prefer to have a ladder to climb, because then we can look where we're going and see where we've been. We can have some sense of power over the people underneath us, and we can play games with the people above us. That's mankind. Well, that may be mankind, but that's not the discipleship that Jesus calls us to. And Jesus calls us to be discriminating in the voices we listen to. Who are we following? Does it come back to the truth of God? Does it chime in with what Jesus said? Or is it just what we want to hear? We have to be careful with the voices we hear. So I suppose the question here is, whose pattern are you learning? Who's shaping your life? What spiritual influences, what sayings, what ideas loom most large in the formation of the person you are? One final thing and we're done, and that's the foundations you build. And Jack's already spoken about this, so I got similar pictures to show you here. Not much to say about those. The house on the rock, the house on the sand. What's the important thing to notice here? Well, I think the important thing is, people often use this passage to preach about the fact that Jesus is the rock, and if you build your life on the rock, then you're fine. And if you build your life on the sand, then you're not a Christian and everything goes badly. Remember, this is spoken to Christians. Jesus is not the rock in this story. Obedience to Jesus is. The man on the rock is not the Christian, and the man on the sand is not the non-Christian. Both of these people are folks, says Jesus, who are hearing my words. They're listening. They're taking in from Jesus. What's the difference? The guy who's building on the rock is obeying what Jesus says. The guy who's building on the sand is hearing it, taking it on board, and then doing something different. And so Jesus says, that's the important thing. If you build on my words, Matthew 28:20, our key verse, if you can't remember what it is, look it up. It's about obedience. It's about doing just what Jesus says, crowning Christ as King. And remember, those are the foundations of the house. Foundations are things you put in first. Ask Graham Goldsworthy. You put them in first. You can't put them in afterwards. Build them in now. And your life is going somewhere. So the question in this one, I suppose, is not how do you assess yourself, what do you depend on, how wide do you wander, or what pattern you're learning, but fifth, how far will you go in obeying the King? And I suppose as we reach the end of our first section of Matthew, those are the questions that we have to confront, all of us. And some of us are plugging away, doing this stuff day by day, crowning Christ as King every morning, living under his authority. Keep going. And check back as you look at these questions on just how you're doing. Let him who thinks he is standing take heed, lest he fall. Some of us are feeling defeated. Some of us are feeling guilty because we've never even started on this. We've lived a pale, anemic kind of Christianity that bears no relation to the real thing. Or else we've tried. We've slipped up. We've become discouraged and we're not doing it. How can you do it? Well, this is where you have to come back to ask, seek, knock. Because Jesus is saying you cannot do this on your own. There is no way you can live this lifestyle by yourself. But everyone who asks receives. Everyone who seeks finds. Everyone who knocks finds that the door swings open. So my challenge to you is, as we've studied the Sermon on the Mount and what Jesus is calling us to, is whether you're prepared to ask, to seek, and to knock. Finish with some words by Stuart Hamblin from that song that I just mentioned. There is no night, for in his light you'll never walk alone. Always feel at home, wherever you may roam. There is no power can conquer you, for God is on your side. Take him at his promise. Don't run away and hide. It is no secret what God can do. What he's done for others, he'll do for you. With arms wide open, he'll welcome you. It's no secret what God can do. Ask, seek, knock.